Hi, everyone. Welcome to IFT's new podcast, Food Disruptors. IFT is a community of scientific scholars, innovators, and visionaries focused on the science of food. We're bringing you Food Disruptors as part of our IFT Next initiative. Over the next few months, we will dig into the ever-evolving intersection of entrepreneurship, innovation, and science. In each episode, our experts in the science of food will discuss some of the most hotly debated issues that we're facing. I'm your host, Matt Teagarden, and today we'll kick things off with the concept of food disruption. What is it exactly, and why is it important? Today I'm joined by John Coupland and Josh Peschel to discuss disruptive innovations and their role in the science of food. John is a professor of food science at Penn State University, a former president of IFT, and a current member of the Keystone section of IFT. Josh is an assistant professor of agricultural and biosystems engineering and a Black & Veatch faculty fellow at Iowa State University. Welcome to the podcast, both of you.
Hi, Matt.
It's good to be with you today.
So I really would love to hear a little bit more about yourselves and your respective research. So John, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I'm a professor here at Penn State. Most of my research is connected with food chemistry. So I'm interested in the way food chemicals can come together and make structure in foods. So that might be proteins, it might be polysaccharides, it might be fats. How these ingredients come together and make foods to have the texture we're looking for it. So products like ice cream and yogurt are kind of the interesting ones for me.
Love ice cream and yogurt. Josh, let's move over to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your research.
Sure. So my students and I here at Iowa State focus our research efforts around what I call sensing and sense making for agricultural, natural, and urban systems. And because each of these areas over time has really been transitioning into what we call cyber human physical systems, that's led us to pursue advances primarily in robotics and computer vision to collect first of its kind data, to ask and answer questions that we've never been able to do so before. So if you look at that big arc of farm to table that we often talk about in the food space, my work is generally on the front side of that arc and relates to the production processes in the system.
That's great. So it seems like we have experts here kind of on growing the food and then kind of bringing that food to the table. So completing that arc, it seems like. That's great. How would you both define food disruption, and what does that term really mean to you?
I'd look at that as any intentional or perhaps unintentional transition, and it could be small or large, in the technologies associated with that farm-to-table arc.
Interesting. John?
It's a hard thing to talk about disruption, isn't it? Because I think a lot of the time, we're used to the idea of change. And I think I'd probably distinguish disruption as being something beyond the sort of incremental change that we do every day. We're all engaged in systems and processes and technologies that we're trying to improve all the time. We're trying to make whatever we do a little bit better, maybe run on a slightly leaner budget, maybe have slightly more consistency or higher quality. To me, disruption is something which changes that. So we're making incremental progress in whatever systems we're working in. This is when another technology, another system, or even another set of values comes in and almost makes what exists now redundant. There's a different way of doing things. There's different rules applying. And eventually people are going to shift over to this new mode of thinking. And eventually that's going to be disrupted in turn. So to me, disruption is like larger scale, but also more upsetting. It's something which is going to break things rather than just expand things.
And John, we seem, you know, this is a hot topic these days, but I imagine that disruption isn't a new concept within the food industry. Is there a historical perspective to food disruption?
Yeah, certainly. I think there's lots of places you could point to. I think that probably the biggest one would be the invention of the refrigerated railroad car in the late 19th century, when they found new ways of moving beef to eastern markets. Because up until that period, every small and medium-sized town in the eastern United States where the population lived would have cattle farms, they'd have their own slaughterhouses, and smaller communities would be raising their own animals themselves and killing pigs and hogs as individuals. Along came the big sort of meat conglomerates in Chicago, and they worked out ways that they could bring meat from the Western prairies, very newly settled by Europeans, kill the cows in Chicago, and then ship them under ice in trains to the big eastern cities and provide cheaper meat there. So we had a sort of technological innovation which was coming in through this refrigerated railroad car. But it's not something that the technological innovation itself made the difference. It had to fit into a big sort of social, cultural space that was ready to receive it. So we had the big growth in the West of land available for Europeans. We had high population in the East, and we had an existing rail network. So this new piece of technology, plus some very aggressive business dealings by the likes of Swift and Armour, were able to make this technology work. And that was a disruption. The things that the Eastern meatpackers had been doing at small scale for decades was all of a sudden disrupted. A new technology, a new way of doing things came in, and their business was broken by it. That to me is the sort of telling historic example of a food disruption.
And it's interesting too how you said that, you know, the technology itself didn't necessarily create the disruption, but the fact that it fit into this so-called arc, as Josh mentioned before, of the from farm to table, it fit into the way that we produce food and bring it to consumers.
Yeah, absolutely. Technology doesn't do things by itself. Technology is something that happens with people. And that technology with those people in that place was able to change things incredibly quickly and gave us the system we're living with now. And what we've been doing since then is trying to make this industrial scale meatpacking system work better. So we've been in a phase since the start of the 20th century where we're just trying to incrementally improve this system. I think the questions we're looking at now is it time for this system to be disrupted? Is another technology going to come in and break this, just like the refrigerated railroad car could fit into late 19th century America and break what they had there?
Yeah, I love how you're kind of bringing that to this wider picture of how these different pieces fit together. So let's take a little bit of a deeper dive into the pieces of this arc that you both work on. So Josh, you do extensive research on urban systems and kind of that beginning part of the arc even of producing food. So can you tell us a little bit more about your work and where you might have seen some of it in action?
Sure, I'll kind of give you the big picture where I'm coming from. My work in the urban environment has focused on lots of different things, but two I'll mention. The first being smart green infrastructure, and I've worked on also intelligent transportation systems. And both really relate in some way to what we might agree is the food space, and John eloquently put it with regard to the rail car example. But I'll talk about the first part, because I think it focuses on an issue that we all have a concern about at some point, and that's water, and specifically its quantity and its quality. So when we look at places like Chicago, we see two things. We see changes to infrastructure itself in terms of the impervious surfaces, which capture larger volumes of precipitation that has been the result of climate dynamics that have come into play. And so these larger storm events produce larger runoff volumes. In places like Chicago and Cincinnati and New York and Philadelphia, the capture systems for that water are what are called combined sewer systems, which means that waste streams coming from homes are combined with runoff coming from flower beds and parking lots and all of these areas. Now, under dry weather conditions, that's fine. All the water flows down the drain and goes to a treatment system as designed, and everything's great. But when you have these wet weather conditions, then you can have an overflow of those systems. And that turns out to be a bad thing because it will either go to a basement or the Chicago River or somewhere downstream, perhaps to a farm. And so what we've tried to do is incorporate green infrastructure. These are natural elements in the urban environment. They may involve food plants, but mostly there are trees and grasses and things like that. The main thing that we work on is trying to make those streets that can act as sponges, we work on making them smarter by wireless sensor networks to assess the flooding. The secondary benefit of being able to include green infrastructure is being able to treat the water itself. So try to improve the water quality. So it really doesn't matter if it's going to a farm or down a street to an urban farm area or rural area. being able to reduce the amount of flooding, but also by improving the water quality, this is an area that we've been tackling in those urban systems. And these developments that we are finding in smart cities, whether they be for green infrastructure or transportation, they're slowly diffusing into the agricultural space through the Internet of Things, this interconnection of different types of computing devices that are embedded in everyday objects, whether it be a roadway or on a livestock animal. And it's allowing these computational devices to send and receive data either through local networks or the internet. The most important thing being, we're now collecting a significant amount of data from which we can make different and better decisions.
How would you classify these developments as disruptive then?
I think that I would characterize them as disruptive mainly because we've not really been able to fully measure the efficacy of these green streetscapes. I think how I might relate them to the food industry, firstly, would be those persons working in urban farming, urban agriculture, okay, because we'd like the water capture that is being utilized in these urban areas to be both available and clean, but it can also help deal with non-point source pollution problems. So all of that water that is essentially going out down to the river that would go out to the farmlands, it really addresses a water quality issue if we can make sure that what's coming from the urban areas is not contaminated in some way when it reaches the cropland.
Do you think there's any ways we could be thinking about that as influencing like wastewater treatment? I know the food industry uses a lot of water for washing down plants and things like that, and trying to make sure that their systems are clean. But we worry about the availability of clean water for that purpose and the amount of water that's being used. I wonder if we could be smarter about that.
Absolutely. I think the ability to reuse water, whether you're an agricultural production facility, pharmaceuticals, the ability to not have to go back to the well or to just not put out water that is of a lower quality than would be desirable in an environment. Absolutely. I think that's a great way to just treat it on the spot so that we just don't have the problem later on.
Well, that's so interesting too. So the topic of water comes up almost everywhere in food science. I feel the supply of water as you're detailing, but then we also have water that drills all the way down to maybe even the molecular level of foods and how it even interacts with the foods. So to talk a little bit and relate this possibly to John's work. So John, you work in the area of food polymers and their functionality. What sort of work does your research entail and what's the benefit of it?
Well, a lot of the things I'm trying to do is to find sort of more interesting things to do with existing food ingredients. So we eat a lot of proteins, we eat a lot of polysaccharides, we eat a lot of fats and oils. Can we bring better types of functionality to that? So one of the projects I've been working on recently is not so much food, but it's in pharmaceuticals. Can we use dairy-based proteins as a way of making oral liquid medications that might be appropriate for children? Can we use those sort of things to suppress unpleasant tastes? And can we make better drugs using food type components? So it's taking something which is very natural, very comfortable, we're very comfortable with this in our diet, and extending it, but using it for some other purposes we're not used to using it now. At the moment, we'd use a lot of these milk proteins for milk and yogurt and cheese and ice cream. I'm looking at some different places we might be able to apply those things. From the point of view of the dairy processor, it probably has some advantages that it might add some value to the milk that's being generated. To the people in the pharmaceutical industry, it might be useful that they can make better drugs. And for the population, it might be useful. It becomes a more acceptable way of using pharmaceuticals without taking in some other ingredients. You might be less comfortable with doing so.
How would you see the developments that have come out of your lab disrupting the science of food?
I think the stuff I'm doing is probably not that disruptive. I think I'm at the stage of extending what we already know, trying to make existing technologies work a little bit better, move them into a slightly different place. I think there are people who are doing things kind of like what I'm doing, probably better funded people than I am. I'm trying to find ways of using polymers in more imaginative ways. And the places I'm thinking of here would be meats. Trying to find ways of making meat analogs out of non-meat sources. I mean, we've been making fake meats forever. I mean, so tofu, seitan, to all the strange things that John Harvey Kellogg came up with in the sanitarium in the early 20th century, some nut meats and things like this. We seem to be turning a corner now of using plant proteins more intelligently to make meat-like products. I think that has the potential to be disruptive, to actually change things around, to make a plant-based meat, which is genuinely as good as a regular hamburger. And I don't think we're there yet, but I think it's an interesting area to be. If you could make this, then all the work of the that we've been engaged in since the refrigerated railroad car in Chicago, of making the industrial meat system run faster and better, all of a sudden would be in a position of being disrupted. What does it mean if we don't need so many cows anymore? It would cause an enormous amount of pain in the communities that are involved in animal agriculture now. But it would be disruptive, and maybe for the better in some regards, if we could make some good plant-based meats.
That's great. And I think it ties in really well to kind of the next train of thought we're going to go down. Researchers estimate that there's going to be over 9 billion people on the planet by 2050. And, you know, there's just so many challenges that we're going to face in trying to bring enough food to the table for them. And so I'm really interested in both of your perspectives on this, both perhaps from like, Josh, more the resource side and kind of the production of food side, and John into the bringing that food to the table. You know, why do you think that food disruption is really critical to advancing the science of food to meet this grand challenge that we'll have?
It's really providing enough food for people to eat. Being able to keep up with those production percentages and standards is substantial. So how do we do that? Well, we need to figure out through the geneticists and the plant breeders, which are the best seeds and the best crops under XYZ conditions of climate dynamics that we might want to grow or bring forward into future generations. So, you know, when I talk about these cyber-physical human systems in agriculture, they're really just ripe for looking at the theoretical, but primarily the practical application. One issue that I can think of as it relates to disruption of the technology is our prior exploration of using small, low-cost tactical robots to do mobile rapid phenotyping, sending small shoebox-sized robots out into fields to take really precise measurements of plants that might be used for foodstuffs or for biofuel production. The state of the practice really is someone going out there with either a measuring stick or spending a significant amount of money using some type of laser scanner. But being able to use pictures to create three-dimensional representations gives the breeders an idea of which are the optimal seed lines to bring forward in the future generations. If you know that, then you can better make decisions with regard to what will give you more biomass for those food necessities, but also for those biofuel productions. And I think at the end of the day, what all of these efforts are really leading to is an enormous corpus of data, which in itself is the commodity from which we can begin to better refine our situational awareness in this agricultural space, really on three levels. Not just firstly understanding what it is in front of us and how well it performs, but secondarily, how two or more issues might perform together, but really trying to get to the third level of situation awareness where we're forecasting into the future how these interconnected agricultural elements or climate elements might perform under, you know, any given set of input conditions.
I've tried to contrast in the past what I see is like the everyday effort of trying to make what we do better, faster, more efficient versus disruption. And at the moment, I think most of the planet's engaged in this sort of small-scale incremental development. We're trying to sort of extend what we've got. And because of the growth in wealth in various parts of the world, what this means is trying to extend an energy-hungry, meat-hungry lifestyle to people in large portions of the planet which have never lived like this. Kind of embedded in that thought is a sense that there's 9 or 10 billion people who'll be eating maybe not cheeseburgers every day, but a higher meat diet and living in certain ways that we can kind of conceive that either we live now or people who've just come into a little bit more wealth in developing countries seem to be selecting for their lifestyle. So what we're trying to do is extend what we're doing more and more and more. It's kind of like blowing up a balloon a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And I think we can see with the environment particularly how the balloon's starting to look a bit thin in places, a bit stretched, and we might be getting a bit worried about, well, can we blow up a balloon this big? And I think here the idea of disruption comes in, ways of doing things differently that reduce the environmental impact while allowing people to have better lifestyles. And I think a lot of Josh's ideas were just spot on for that, of different ways of being able to do things, energy and water and food, making those things work better. I think the biggest trouble, though, is that the economic interests are lined up with fairly wealthy people who are interested in just extending the current system rather than seeing what the economic and societal needs are. I think probably for disruption, the biggest issue is getting political will and financial power sort of lined up around some of these big issues that I just don't see that happening as much as I would like to see at the moment. Probably if I was going to point to a sort of modern disruption that's happening now, it would be cell phones in the hands of poor farmers in developing countries. A very everyday technology. It wasn't built to help farmers in poor countries, but it's being used by them to give them more market information, more knowledge, more capacity to exchange capital. So it's giving them powers that they wouldn't have had without this technology. It's not a technology that's developed for them. It's a technology that's sort of leaked out of our current systems. And I think there's some other examples along those lines of technology getting into the hands of poor people and really improving their lives that I'd point to as being quite exciting in the terms of potential disruption.
So John mentioned the advancement and the ubiquity of a lot of this technology transitioning to parts of the developing world. And this is something that I've seen firsthand in India, where we have this democratization of the cell phone or the smartphone or the Android tablet, where we've been in extremely rural areas of India. And you would never think that you would walk up to a place and a farmer there would be holding an Android tablet with a satellite image of his particular fields and would know down to the level of where irrigation needs to go or what needs to be planted next or what type of microdiversion needs to go in place. But it is absolutely out there in the places that you would often not expect. Now that they have it, they want more. And so I think that there is a societal demand now that we've had this democratization of smart cell phone tablet technology to advance in the software, at least, the ability to do better decision making in those very remote areas where often data is sparse, but it can have a significant improvement and impact in the lives of those daily food producers.
It's so easy to talk about food disruption maybe in the context of America, for instance. You know, we can make new burgers that look like ground beef, but really it's made out of vegetables and that's great. And it's, you know, that has a lot of benefits, but some of these things just seem to slowly leak out of this balloon that we have kind of on our end of things. And so how do we maybe speed up the process of that leak and getting some of these disruptive advancements to these countries that could certainly need them? Do we need to hurry that process up?
Primarily, we need to address the economy of scale that's going on. When we talk about those phenotyping robots, they would be just as advantageous to have in India to look at rice as they would to look at sorghum in East Central Illinois or in Iowa. But they can't cost $50,000.
Right.
They can't be thousands of dollars. They either have to be free or they have to be at a cost that people have access to. There are not going to be the same kinds of profits that you might see in a lot of the commercial agricultural space. Otherwise, we're not going to have that adoption in those countries. But having that technology in those countries, I think the return will be remarkable for those people. But economy of scale is the big issue.
I tend to think that technologies which give poor people more choices are probably the ones to go for rather than ones which are just worked out outside their space and kind of handed to them.
Disruption can happen everywhere, kind of in our grand food system all over the globe.
That's not necessarily good. I think sometimes we've sort of grown up in this space, Silicon Valley, giving us this word disruption. Disruption breaks things as well. And so I think we do need to be a little bit critical that is this always going to be a good thing? And for who?
What's kind of the next big thing for your research and what's really on the horizon for you?
Computational ethology. Trying to understand animal behavior from those same real-time video streams that we're getting off of those green streetscapes and looking at automobiles in cities on highways. And we're doing this because we want to know in real time a health assessment and also get the phenotyping information of production livestock to essentially improve efficiencies. We're trying to know that the calf is sick before the calf itself knows it's sick. And so being able to, let's say, pull an animal out of a production facility, whether it be a calf or a pig or a chicken or what have you, that may be developing an illness would allow us to strategically target vaccinations or antibiotics. It would prevent the spread of diseases. It would improve situations where you may have a significant number of animals die. I think the statistics say something around 4 or 5%, but if we're talking in the millions of animals that are dying from non-predator related instances, this is something that could be really advantageous. The state of the practice is, again, a human walking around and looking at where a sick animal might be exhibiting some behavior. If we can train cameras on them and recognize those little subtle behaviors or differences, then that would allow us to strategically target and optimize those types of livestock production efficiencies. That's, I think, the next big thing and where we've put a lot of our efforts in right now.
Wow. Have you thought of a name for that? Have you thought of calling it like CowCam or something like that?
Well, yeah, we haven't come up with a name, but I'll tell you the one thing that we really like is that the cows don't seem to care too much about privacy issues. So we're probably okay for now.
Should start like an Instagram account for them. John, how about you?
I'm going to be looking a little bit more on plant-based meals. There's a collaboration we're starting up at Penn State to try and look at this area and bring in some scientists like me involved in the formation of these things, but also people in ethics and sociology and social science and leadership development to see if we can take a more holistic view at the challenges of supporting a more plant-based diet.
This is really going to take need to take more of a multidisciplinary, cross-disciplinary approach. And it sounds like both of you kind of integrate other aspects of different types of research into your own. And I think that's great. I think it really helps, you know, build us towards, you know, solving these big problems that we're going to have.
It's a critical way of thinking about things, that technology doesn't come in and just solve problems for us. Technology is going to be something people use to do good things and bad things for different people in different places. And I think just thinking about it a little bit more would help the technologists make better technology and maybe address some of these bigger issues we're worried about.
Any other final parting thoughts either of you would like to share?
I often talk to people about what I think the most exciting part of what it is that I do with my students and in our research lab here. And really the most exciting part is that we don't really know what interdisciplinary rabbit hole that we're going to stumble upon next. This whole area of cyber human physical systems is really starting to take off. And so while I think it's very satisfying in engineering to discover, you know, some entirely new process, but it's incredibly exciting to be able to take what might be an existing technology that was perhaps developed for an entirely different purpose. And if we can refine it and advance it and move it in an entirely new direction to solve a never before attempted problem, that is very, perhaps the most exciting thing for us to do in our work.
Yeah, I think that sounds a really cool approach you got there, Josh. I think you're right. The one I was thinking of as like a parting thing is perhaps looking at some present disruptions in perhaps the US food system We see an awful lot of big companies buying small companies and the values of existing brands seeming to fragment as we watch things that seem very stable are changing an awful lot. And I think we're really seeing the technology that's allowing this, kind of like the refrigerated rail car of the 21st century, is all about communication, logistics, and networks, but really applied to food brands. The fact that we can order and get delivered exactly what we want from Amazon or Whole Foods or whatever store we're working with on the internet kind of changes the balance of power in our food system. So there's not necessarily one supermarket that's going to keep us happy, but there's this vast selection of whatever else is available on the internet, and we can get things kind of customized to our wants. And I think what you're seeing now is kind of big brands fragmenting because of this, that an individual's needs and wants, which are very often sort of political and ethical, can now be satisfied with smaller personalized brands, which are just tailored towards them. If you're worried about strange chemicals in your food, there's going to be a sub-brand which sells less of these chemicals. If you're worried about pesticides, there's going to be a pesticide-free option that's available for a premium. It can be shipped around the place using these kind of logistics technologies and kind of customized just to you. I think there's a real parallel here between what we've seen as a fragmentation of the existing news media, where it used to be a few networks which told America what the truth was. Now Americans can pick their own truth and get exactly what they want tailored to them and delivered to them. I think we're seeing that sort of personalization of want reflected in brands now. People are able to pick more precisely what they want. And I'd really hold this up as probably a disruption that might not be as helpful as we'd like. It allows us to sort of buy these food products which seem to fit our sense of what's good in the world without necessarily addressing any of the evils we might be worried about in the first place. We just consume in a way that makes us feel better about ourselves. That becomes a limiting factor to action.
Absolutely. It's a little strange to think about the Internet of Things and how it might relate to food and really wrap my head around that, because it's so, you know, conflated with terms like Bitcoin and blockchain. Are there any sort of applications for these newer technologies that are really affecting a lot of different areas of the world?
It's hard to know. I mean, all these things are moving incredibly fast at the moment, and which ones make sense in which place is something which we'll discover as time works out. I have heard of interesting stuff being done with blockchain, though, around ensuring authenticity of food ingredients to make sure that the stuff you're buying is the stuff you think you're paying for. There's been lots of challenges recently around food adulteration scandals. There was the horse meat scandal in Ireland and in Britain in 2013, 2014. Which was based on very long supply chains and people really not knowing who was buying what and who was selling what, and horse ending up in Irish supermarkets and in English supermarkets. I think technologies like blockchain give you some scope to track things perhaps a little bit more precisely, but how and where they get taken up is going to be hard to see. I think other places it might turn out to be important would be areas like fish authenticity. We have a lot of worries now about overfishing and fish coming from the wrong places or the wrong species being passed off as higher value species. I think there's some good possibilities of using technology like blockchain as a way of managing this type of problem.
I just like what John had to say at the end about the customization and the desire for personalization of food, because I was thinking the entire time as he was describing it, was that if you look at the customization in the context of, let's say, Amazon.com or Netflix, and the gravitation of society to that demand for customization, as that transitions towards food, if there's any similarities in terms of those demands, it's really going to take off.
Thanks so much for your time, Josh and John. That was a great discussion. We've talked a lot today about how innovation and out-of-the-box thinking are needed to tackle global food challenges. But before I close out, I'd like to take a moment to mention the IFT Next Food Disruption Challenge, a competition designed to help emerging and investment-ready food companies advance the science of food and its positive impact on our global food supply. The competition finals will take place this July during IFT's annual event in Chicago, IFT 18, where finalists will participate in a high-profile pitch emceed by renowned entrepreneur Damon John of ABC's Shark Tank. The winner of IFT Next Future Food Disruptor of the Year Award will receive a cash prize of $25,000, as well as services and products designed to help them advance their business. To learn more about the competition and how you can participate, visit ift.org/fooddisruption. If you liked what you heard today, let us know by sharing your thoughts on our social channels, at IFT on Twitter and Institute of Food Technologists on Facebook and LinkedIn. Our social channels are also the best place to find out news and information on upcoming episodes of Food Disruptors. You can also visit ift.org for more great content. I'm your host, Matt Teagarden. Have a great day, everyone.